Mac Tonies, he died in October of 2009, also way too young. Author of After the Martian Apocalypse, he has maintained a special series of incredible award-winning UFO documentaries, one called Best Evidence. Here is my conversation back in September of 2009, a month before he passed on, with Mac Tonies. How do you see the human race in the next 100 to 200 years, Mac?
Very likely no longer the human race. And that could be a very good thing, or it could be a very bad thing. It kind of depends on your perspective. But I foresee the human race either merging with its technology to the point where we'll no longer technically be Homo sapiens anymore. We'll be something new and different. Or we might not make it. I think we're living at an excruciatingly crucial point in history. I mean, not too many times in history has there been a time like this when we either make it or break it. I mean, once 70,000 years ago, there were an estimated 5,000 humans on the planet. And we could be approaching a point that's comparable to that. And that's rather frightening. Hopefully it won't be that bad. I'd like to, the optimist in me wants me to think that it won't get that bad at all, that it will get better, that things will improve. But it's kind of a weird, I kind of walk the edge on that one, because I'm not sure. I'd say as far as the glass half empty, glass half full, I'm probably somewhere in the middle, unable to make up my mind which glass I'd pick.
Whichever way you do pick, it's going to be a remarkable 100 to 200 years.
Absolutely. It's going to be an epic, unparalleled 200 years or 100 years. Time seems to be going faster, at least subjectively. Moore's Law has kind of seen that out on the technological front, whether that will... whether human consciousness will respond to accompany that is an interesting question that remains unresolved. But certainly we seem to be feeling the effects of history in a much faster way, made possible at least in part because of this electronic nervous system that we have now, that the planet has. And it's conceivable that the planet might begin to wake up, or has already begun the process of waking up and becoming aware in a way that it has never been aware before. Sometimes I'm tempted to draw a parallel between James Lovelock's Gaia hypothesis that suggests that the Earth is a big homeostatic organism, self-contained, takes care of itself. And humans might be epiphenomenal. We might just be little maggots on the surface of the planet, but that's not necessarily a diminishing thing. We could be building something bigger and better than ourselves that could very well supplant us. And some people react to the prospect that we might be replaced by robotic surrogates or some sort of artificial intelligence that encircles the globe as a negative development, because our media generally depicts it in apocalyptic terms, the Terminator movies, for example, or the Matrix. But if we are a transitional state between carbon-based intelligence and something more capable and more compassionate and wiser, then I don't see a huge problem with it. I don't take it personally. Of course, I'd like life and intelligence to keep existing.
Sure.
But if it's not necessarily carbon-based, if it's not necessarily us, then so be it. I'm not exactly troubled by that notion. I think some people are. Evolution has never been static. Things have always been in flux, and we've only existed, and I say we, meaning the human race. I mean, the human race is just a quick little blip on the radar of evolution. So I guess I can state with a reasonable amount of confidence that it's not going to be the same kind of us that's going to be walking the Earth in 200 years, or for that matter, navigating the solar system in 200 years. But if we can survive the next 50 to 100 years, I would tend to think that things will be very good indeed.
Is that a big if, though?
I think it's a big if. I think there's obviously this it's an area that's been challenged and debated quite noisily in the last say 10 years. The idea that the human race might be at the point of an existential crisis and could conceivably wipe itself off the face of the earth or fall prey to a cosmic accident, say a meteorite collision or something like that. Yeah, I mean that's a serious subject, and I've never it's reaching a point in scholarly debate that I've never seen before. So it's being taken seriously, and the idea that we're doomed, at least in potential, is becoming a mainstream idea, and I think this whole 2012 phenomenon has kind of catalyzed that, and in the public mind at least. I think that's. I think this infatuation with apocalyptic scenarios is healthy in a certain respect.
Sure. I've heard the debate too on both ends, where some people think it's going to be an apocalypse. Others believe it's an era of enlightenment. Yet most people want to hear about the catastrophes that could hit us.
Absolutely. Catastrophes make great special effects on cinema screens and in the human imagination, I think. And I think a kind of a collective fascination with a destructive apocalyptic scenarios is, in a certain respect, a good thing. Because at least there is a sort of acknowledgement that there is an issue. On the other hand, it's also probably the least imaginative approach to take. It takes a lot more intellectual gusto, for example, to envision a utopian future.
Sure.
There are some very positive technologies being developed and already developed that would allow us to continue in a much grander sense, a much more robust and vigorous way on the planet. And we don't see too many movies exploring these possibilities. So I wish the apocalyptic movies, disastrous apocalyptic movies would share some screen time with some more liberating scenarios. That would be my complaint with Hollywood's treatment of the idea.
Mac, have you looked at folklore in direct relation to ETs?
I think if you were to investigate the UFO phenomenon, a nice look at the folkloric parallels is pretty essential, and that's something that you don't find a lot. Reading the books of your kind of old school UFO researchers, you find that they come from a very nuts and bolts perspective.
Right.
And there's nothing that's Stanton really wrong with that, but it's limiting.
There have always been references, for example, to like leprechauns and little people. And are people looking at other entities? Or are they looking at ETs possibly?
That's one idea is that the leprechauns, the little people, the fairies, every tradition on the planet has a history of little people coming from the sky usually, and they usually have an interest in human reproduction, strangely enough. And this seems to be what we're seeing with the UFO phenomenon, beings with an interest in reproduction, and they happen to be small in stature as well. So it's in keeping with this long tradition. And there are different ways of approaching this. One way of approaching it is that, these people in history, they were seeing aliens and seeing them in their own mythological context. They were seeing them in light of what they could handle. The other avenue that was explored by Jacques Vallée in his book, Password to Magonia,
right,
was that we're dealing with a phenomenon that's none of the above. It's an alien stimulus, and we don't know where exactly it's coming from. And each culture is seeing something that to them is perfectly valid. And to us, we're seeing it, and it takes the form of space travelers, because that makes sense to us. It would be absurd for us to see little magical beings, because that doesn't jive with Western science, Western materialism. It's an outdated paradigm. So just because the aliens appear to be space travelers, at least in many respects, doesn't necessarily mean that they are. We could be dealing with something even stranger. And that's a problem that I've attempted to address with this crypto-terrestrial hypothesis. Could we be dealing with a species that evolves here on Earth that has deliberately insinuated itself into our mythologies, into our folklore, in an attempt to disguise itself, but at the same time perhaps exerts some form of control over our social systems. And again, this is kind of Jacques Vallée's idea of a psychosocial thermostat or control system. And that it's kind of an ominous notion. It's not necessarily something you'd like to think about, that, you know, human existence is some sort of kept on a dial, and there's someone turning the dial, mm-hmm. keeping everything in accordance with some ideal of which we know nothing. But maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's benign. Maybe this phenomenon and all this other strange phenomena that preceded it constitute something, an evolutionary process at work. Whitley Strieber has remarked once, I thought it was a very astute observation. He said maybe the UFO phenomenon is nothing more than what evolution looks like to the conscious mind. And that's kind of a cryptic statement, kind of causes you to kind of scratch your head and think about it for a second. But, you know, I think that's as good an explanation for the UFO phenomenon as any I've heard, quite honestly. And it could be entirely wrong, but I don't think that anyone has the answers. And that's one part of the UFO debate, such as it is, that I'm really dissatisfied with. I think the UFO debate has become excessively polarized in favor of the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And in the years since that has become the veritable gospel of this strange phenomenon, this strange going on.
Is that because it's easier to comprehend?
I think you hit the nail on the head. Yeah, I think it's easier to comprehend. It's kind of a knee-jerk reaction. It makes sense. There's nothing wrong with it. And, you know, we could be dealing with disparate phenomena that happen to look the same to us, you know, as organisms with fairly limited concepts at their disposal. But yeah, I think the extraterrestrial idea is the most logical. You know, you see something in the sky that you can't explain, and it appears to be a structured vehicle. Well, you know, you can rule out certain countries. You know, when this phenomenon began, it was Russia we were concerned about. Could these be Russian reconnaissance devices, or, you know, bombers? What could they be? You know, we were able to rule out terrestrial superpowers making these aircraft. So, well, they came from elsewhere, you know, outer space. So that became the, you know, the parting line. And soon after, the term flying saucer was replaced with UFO, simply to make it seem more innocuous. But nonetheless, UFO still remains semantically linked with the idea of space visitors. And certainly we could be being visited by beings from other planets, but I don't think we have any conclusive proof of that. And when people discuss the UFO controversy, it's almost always in terms of extraterrestrials. And certainly we should be talking about the possibility that we're being visited. Frankly, I'd be surprised if we weren't visited occasionally. There's nothing ludicrous about that.
And it's probably been ongoing, you know that.
I would think it would be ongoing. But the UFO phenomenon as we popularly see it and talk about it and see it on films and et cetera, doesn't conform to what I personally would expect an alien civilization from another star system to look like. The behavior is very conspicuous. It seems to deliberately draw attention to itself at the same time that it denies its own existence. We have cases like the Malmstrom Air Force Base case, where these unknown objects hover over a nuclear installation and turn off the missiles one by one. You know, this is quite dramatic. And why would an alien civilization, some sort of arbitrarily advanced extraterrestrial species, what interest would they have in doing something like this? If we share the planet with an indigenous, you know, humanoid intelligence, or indigenous intelligence, it wouldn't even necessarily have to be humanoid, that offers a possible explanation about why we see these acts, these interference cases with military aircraft, nuclear missile silos. You know, maybe they share the planet with us, and they are concerned for their own well-being. Maybe they're not doing it for us. You know, we're a very selfish species, and when we encounter a case like the Malmstrom Air Force Base, where these missiles were shut down by these apparent glowing red objects, we tend to think, well, you know, they were showing us a message. It was a demonstration for us to turn off our nuclear missiles because presumably the space people don't like nuclear war.
And well, maybe an atomic weapon in a blast, Mac, tears apart something between space and time. Maybe it rips it to shreds and it affects them somehow.
Yeah, in the early days, I should say, of the UFO phenomenon, that was the idea behind the Roswell crash, that they were attracted to that area of the Southwest because that's where we were testing out nuclear bombs, and they were frightened by that because the radiation or something was impacting the cosmos in a way that we weren't able to appreciate at the time. And it's a valid point, and I suppose you could fall back on Stan Friedman's point that they were afraid that we were becoming an aggressive space-faring species, and they wanted to see what was up before it got out of hand, before we started entering space in a more vigorous way.
Well, there's no question. I think one glimpse of this planet at any given time, you would say, my gosh, all they do is fight.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. But at the same time, you look at this planet, and I don't see us going anywhere anytime soon in any meaningful way. I mean, there might be a mission to Mars in 20 years. I mean, you're hearing stories like this, and it's encouraging in a sense. But at the same time, it also highlights just how tenuous our presence in space is. I don't think we're going to be visiting the interstellar neighborhood anytime soon. And I think we're going. I think we're stuck on Earth for a while, unfortunately, for the most part. I mean, there might be a few people visiting the Moon and Mars in the next 50 years, and that's great. But as far as being a menace to a highly advanced species out there in space, I don't see it. I don't see how we would be a possible threat against a species even 100 years in our advance, let alone millions of years, which is what we very well might be dealing with if these alleged beings are indeed out there and hailing from other planets.
Friday night we're doing a two-hour special because of the 50th anniversary of the Twilight Zone. And today I had an opportunity to interview William Shatner on tape, and we're going to play a portion of it Friday night, Mac. He's been on the program before. He was in two great Twilight Zone episodes, Nick of Time and then the scary one of in space, where he was on a plane and saw the gremlins on the wing. And you know, I talked with him just about space because Star Trek, of course, catapulted his career. And in that area, everyone was a Federation. You know, life was good. They were all there to take care of each other, and they band together. I'm not so sure that would happen in this existence. Are you?
I don't know. Sometimes I think that if species become sufficiently advanced to the point where they're out in the galaxy roaming around, space might be so big that tensions might not even exist in the first place simply because there's an excess of space. If you want to do something you enjoy, you can go elsewhere, but there's enough room. I could be totally naive with that, though. I mean, there are some phenomena in the galactic neighborhood that that you could possibly exploit for energy resources.
That was Mac Tonies. Up next, one final guest who had just an incredible, incredible story to tell. We'll be back. Lloyd Pye passed away December 2013. He was, of course, the caretaker of the famous Star Child skull, and he believes it could make history as big as history can get. He came close to trying to find out the origin of the skull, but he just could never get the final answer. Lloyd, you're getting close, aren't you?
We definitely are, George. There's no doubt about it that we've had a major, major breakthrough with this recovery of a fragment from one of the working areas of the human genome, and that it's not just a working area, it is one of the most important working areas. So we've really never had a better thing happen to us in all of the 13 years of research we've been doing.
Quick highlight on what the Star Child skull is, Lloyd.
The Star Child is it is a true bone skull found in Mexico in about 1930. That people for most of those years until the early 90s believed was a deformity. And then in the late 90s, It came into the hands of a couple, Ray and Melanie Young of El Paso, Texas, and Melanie had been a neonatal nurse, and she suspected that it was not, in fact, a deformity, as everyone had assumed, that it was too symmetrical, the bone was too light. It just, nothing about it looked human. None of its physical parts are, in fact, matched with a human. So she was convinced that it was something else and came to believe that it was likely the skull that would belong in the head of a gray alien. And eventually I came to believe that as well. And then for a long time, we thought it was a hybrid. But then as more refined genetic techniques came online and we began to apply those to it, within the last couple of years, we've had three major areas of discovery that have shown in every case that it's not human alien hybrid, it's just an alien.
It's straight alien. Explain what the skull looks like, Lloyd. Paint us a picture here.
Well, it has a human-like appearance, except none of its parts are like a human. Its eye sockets are very shallow. It has a very different alignment of its neck area. Its neck is about half the size of ours. Its brain is much larger for the size of the skull than it should be. It has no frontal sinuses. It has much larger inner ears. It has the knot in the center of the rear of the head that we all have where our neck connects. It has a dent back there. Its neck doesn't connect there. It connects in a completely different place. It's flat in the rear of the head, but the upper left and right rear parts of the head are expanded, and yet it has a crease down the middle of that. All of these things, and it has a very small lower face and a roof of its mouth is flat instead of arched. Everything about it indicates it has a very small, narrow lower face, even though the lower jaw is missing, and it has just that heart-shaped look that people who see gray aliens say that they have. It has those outward physical features are in that skull. So it's not impossible at all that it is, in fact, the skull of a gray alien.
Can you tell what kind of a nose it had, Lloyd? You know, slits or a human-like nose?
No, we don't have that, but we do know that it's different from a human, significantly different from a human nose, in that if you look at a human skull, you'll see that as the brow ridges, from the brow ridges down to the nose, there's almost invariably a dip of sorts, of some degree or another. There's either, you know, can be as large or very small, but there from the brow ridge down, there's a dip. Starchild doesn't have brow ridges, and there's no dip at all. And the nose, instead of being narrow at the top and widening as it goes down, starts out at what looks like the same length that's going to carry all the way down. So, but it's broken off in the middle, so we can't be absolutely sure of that. But certainly at the top, it is designed completely different from a human nose, as are the brows above those very shallow eye sockets.
Does it look more human than like a gray would look?
I don't know. I think it looks more like a gray, frankly.
You do?
There are no physical parts of the Starchild skull that match up where you can say, oh, that's just like it is in a human. There's not a part of it, not a single part of it, that you can say that to. Plus, notwithstanding the fact that the bone is just completely different. The bone is much lighter, it's much thinner, and it's two or three times as hard. It's like cutting sheet metal when you try to cut the bone. It's very, very different because it's loaded up with collagen, and that collagen is to the extent that we have in the enamel of our teeth, which is the hardest parts of our body. The whole skull is like that. So, plus, and on top of that, you have fibers woven through the matrix of the bone, very durable fibers that are in there like rebar and concrete to add extra strength to it. So that is just not human. Not only is it not human, there's no other bone on earth like that. That bone, the bone in the Starchild, is absolutely unique on planet Earth.
And Lloyd, if it was an ET, what was it doing there? What do you
think? That's a very, very good question. I would suspect maybe that its ship might have crashed. You know, its craft might have crashed. I don't know. It was visiting and couldn't get away. It fell sick, fell ill, died. There are any number of scenarios one can suggest. But so far as I know, it's the only one of its kind that's ever been found here. So that's my best guess, or at least never come to light. And 900 years ago, who knows what was going on, what brought it here, what caused it to die here. We can spin scenarios all night long.
That's true. And we call it a Starchild skull primarily because it was found near the bones of a human woman, right?
Well, no, it was found near the bones of a human woman, but we thought it was a child because the initial test that we had done was x-rays that indicated that the piece of maxilla that was with it had teeth down and teeth buried up in the bone of the maxilla. So the guy just said, oh, well, if you have teeth down and teeth up, that's a kid in the range of 5 or 6 years old. So we just said, okay, it's a star child. Later, when dental experts began to examine it, it came and skull experts began to examine the degree of suturing in the skull. Everybody agreed, no, this is an adult of some advanced years because the teeth that were there were considerably worn, much more than a child could ever do.
Tell us more then about what's happening with this human genome project with it.
Well, we've had a geneticist who's been doing, as finances permit, what's called shotgunning, which is where you just go in and you just take whatever comes out at random.
Right.
And you hope for the best. In the Starchild genome, as in we assume it's going to be like a human genome or the higher primates genomes, of around 3 billion base pairs. We have a little over 3 billion base pairs. Chimps do, Neanderthals do. So we figure it's going to be in that ballpark somewhere. He has pulled out over 30,000 base pairs of those 3 billion. So it sounds like a big number, but it's really 0.001%. And all of it, unfortunately, up until recently, has been in the non-working parts of it, the non-coding, or what people know as junk DNA. Everybody has heard that term, junk DNA.
That's right.
About 98% of the whole 3 billion base pairs, about 98% of our genome, doesn't do anything. It certainly doesn't make proteins that the rest of the working 2% makes. Now, to say it doesn't do anything, that's not necessarily true because our body conserves it very well. Year after year, human after human, those aspects of our genome are conserved. So they're doing something, but nobody can figure out what. It's not making proteins. Only about 2% do that. That's the working part. So the geneticist always said, we have to pull something out of the working part. He began to call it the golden needle in the massive haystack. We have to find a fragment out of the working part so I can see what proteins it makes, so I can compare it to something that we know and understand and, see how it compares. Everything he was pulling out of the 30,000 of the non-working part didn't look like human DNA. You run it through the NIH database and it comes back. Some of it is human-like, some of it they can't find in the database, which means it's not likely to be found on Earth, so it's very, very different. And then he recovered 4 fragments of the mitochondrial DNA, and that was extremely shocking because in mitochondrial DNA, in all 16,569 base pairs in all human mitochondrial DNA, there are a maximum of 120 mutations, maximum. The oldest of us, black Africans from South Africa, have 120 maximum of those 16,569 base pairs. Neanderthals have 200 different mutations. The new hominin, Denisovans, they have 385. The Starchild projects, based on the 4 fragments that we have, which is almost 10%, projects to have between 800 and 1,000.
Lloyd, if this creature happened to have been all human, would you have known that by now?
I think we would, absolutely. I don't think there's any mistake, and especially with the new thing that I was talking about, beginning to talk about as we ended the last segment. As I told you, we were looking for something out of the working part of it, and finally, not only did he find a golden needle, he found a diamond needle. Not only did he find it from a working part, did he get a fragment from a working part, he got a fragment from one of the most important parts in the human body, one of the most important genes, and not just in human bodies, everything has one of these. It's called a FOXP2, which is a contraction of Forkhead box P2. And what it does is it is a master gene. It controls in your body the effects of 300 other genes. There's a downstream cascade. When the FOXP2 makes proteins, they go down and they impact 300 other genes. So when you're being made, when you're gestating, when your brain is being made, when your voice mechanism is being made, your heart, your lungs, your guts, the whole, from head to in your torso, not your limbs, but your torso, the inner parts of you, that's what's being made apart by the FOXP2 and other things. So when something goes wrong in the FOXP2, it's a disaster. You can't, there are just a few known mutations in it. And it's only one base pair, one nucleotide, one single nucleotide polymorphism or SNP out of 2,594. That gene is 2,594 base pairs long. And if one goes wrong, you lose your ability to speak. You will never be able to speak. But there are only two or three things like that that are acceptable as mutations that don't kill you, see? So it's one of the most highly preserved genes in the human body. And all of us, George, who are normal, mm-hmm. all of us who are normal.
I don't think any of us are normal, Lloyd.
But all of us who are health-wise normal, all right. Let's leave it at that, health-wise normal, have the exact same array of base pairs in that gene. All 2,594 are exactly the same in you and me and virtually everybody listening to my voice right now. The same. No variation allowed in this important gene, because why? Anything goes wrong, the spill down to 300 is going to kill the fetus, and that's it. So if you're born, you have it right. Now, the star child, we have a fragment of that gene, 211 base pairs long. 211. That's 8% of the whole thing. That's a pretty good size fragment.
It's sure
a great size to recover from something that size. Much, much better, 9.5% with the mitochondrial DNA in four fragments. In one fragment, we have 8%. So we can tell an awful lot about this from those 211 base pairs. If you pull the same exact 211 base pair fragment out of the human genome and you pull it out of some other animals like a mouse, a dog, an elephant, a possum, a kind of a frog called a Xenopus, all of these things are visible, or you can see it for yourself on the new essay that has been posted on the Star Child Project website. I invite you all to go take a look and look at the illustrations there. But on the Star Child Project website, on the menu on the left, you'll see something that says DNA latest. Click on that, and boom, there you'll see the essay, and in there are the diagrams. And you'll see that in the 211 fragment for a rhesus monkey, you have only two base pair differences. Two of the base pairs of the 211 are different in a rhesus monkey. In the mouse, you have 20. In the dog, you have 27. In the elephant, you have 21. In the possum, you have 26. In the frog, in the possum, you have 21. In the frog, you have 26, right?
Right.
These are differences, single base pair differences in that 211 base pair fragment in all these different animals. In the human, they're all what they are. And the star child, relative to the human, all those differences are relative to the human that I just told you. Relative to the star child, there are 56 differences, George.
Wow.
Twice
as much.
Any other animal, twice as much as the frog or the dog or any other thing that's high up. In other words, the star child is stranger than any animal on Earth. It's has more variation in that one fragment. And if you expand that out, just like with the fragments of the mitochondrial DNA, if you expand that out to 100%, it is so different. It's 50% different. I mean, it's just incredible. You can't have 1, 2, 3 max and you're dead, and the star child has 56 in a 211 base pair fragment. It would extrapolate out to about 600 in the whole gene.
This could be the evidence we all need.
It is. I mean, it is. Now, what I have no idea how science is going to try to talk its way around this one. They're just going to say, well, it's still a fragment. They haven't proved it yet. You have to recover the whole genome. Well, that's true. We do. We still need the money. We still need the investment money. We still need to do a full recovery of the whole genome. I'm not arguing that. What I'm saying to you and everybody is we have now enough evidence that an investor who is a moron ought to see that we can do this, that all they've got to do is give us what we need, and we're going to be able to make history at a level that history is virtually never made. We are going to change all of reality for all of humans who are all the humans who are alive and all the humans that are ever going to be born in the future. Our lives will never be the same. This is the equivalent of the Wright brothers flying and putting us in the air. This is the equivalent of going to the moon and putting us into space. This puts us all of us in a whole new reality, and it's going to happen. Sooner or later now, and now it looks like much sooner, we're going to find somebody with sense enough to see, you know, these guys really have something here. So that we're very excited about it. We could hardly be more excited. It's the thing we've been looking for. And as I said, the geneticists had been saying, we need a golden needle. We need a golden needle. And when he called me to say what he had, he says, it's a diamond needle. It's way better than we had hoped for, because you just... The FOXP2 is so respected for the power that it has and for its high, high, high degree of conservation, of its lack of mutations in all humans.
Lloyd Pye, they'll all be missed. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, George Knapp, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.